Dangerous people can fall through the cracks, in part because the background check system lacks a clear definition of mentally incompetent.
Senator Begich's answer to tightening the nation's gun laws. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, March 6th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the different strategies of race leaders along the Iditarod Trail.
I have a team that's doing just fine right now, so I choose to let them do what they think they need to do because I know what I'm doing can work.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD, or paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
U.S. Senator Mark Begich is introducing a bill aiming to clarify who would be unable to own a gun because of mental illness, as APRN's Peter Granitz reports.
South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham tells the story of Alice Boland to make his case. She was charged in 2005 of threatening to kill members of Congress and then President George W. Bush.
In 2013, this young lady, who is a paranoid schizophrenic, previously pled not guilty by reason of sanity to threatening to kill the President of the United States, was admitted to a mental health treatment facility, found by a federal court to be a risk to herself and others, went to Waldoboro, South Carolina, in February of this year, and legally purchased a firearm.
And she took that gun to a school where she was unable to fire a shot. Senator Graham calls Boland one of the 14,000 in his state who have been through federal courts or other adjudicative bodies and yet managed to pass background checks. Senator Begich says he does not know how many people fit that qualification in Alaska, but he estimates the number to be in the thousands.
Dangerous people can fall through the cracks, in part because the background check system lacks a clear definition of mentally incompetent.
The bill would define who would be barred from owning a gun because of mental illness. People who have been found not guilty by reason of insanity. People who have been involuntarily committed to psychiatric hospitals. People who have been deemed incompetent to stand trial in a criminal case. The bill appears non-controversial. It does not address requirements for universal background checks. That's something that Senator Begich says gives him heartburn. He says it's unrealistic to require background checks in remote villages. Both Senator Graham and Begich oppose an assault weapons ban. So does Senator Mark Pryor, a Democrat from Arkansas and co-sponsor of this new bill. And Jeff Flake, the final co-sponsor, says he'd have a hard time supporting a new ban. Senator Begich says they're trying to move legislation lawmakers can agree on.
We're finding a piece of the puzzle that you can get a fairly strong bipartisan support on. You know, we don't want to get caught up in all the other issues, but let's try to move forward and make some difference.
Those other issues, like the assault weapons ban, will get their time in the spotlight Thursday morning when the Senate Judiciary Committee marks them up. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
For the past 2 days, the House Finance Committee has heard testimony on what it should cut from the operating budget and what it should not. Opposition has been especially vocal when it comes to an $8.4 million reduction in behavioral health funding. Kathy Collum serves on the board of Juno Youth Services, an organization that receives state grants. Her son also received treatment there. Collum urged the Finance Committee to keep funding for behavioral and mental health at the level set by the governor's budget. She says the money spent on her son benefited him and the state.
I feel that a year at Miller House is what prevented my son from becoming another faceless number in an overcrowded prison system.
The $8.4 million cut isn't from any specific program. It's getting rid of a pot of money that hasn't actually been allocated. The concern is that by moving it from the budget, it could lower the base funding level for behavioral health in future years. Representative Lindsey Holmes, an Anchorage Republican, says the committee is focused on tightening the budget in the face of a deficit, but that they are taking the public's testimony very seriously.
we hope people keep in mind that I know there are certain changes that have been made to the budget that have a lot of people concerned. It is a long process. This is one of the very early stages.
The Finance Committee is expected to start taking amendments on the budget as soon as Monday. On day four of the Iditarod, the race is still anyone's game. And the mushers are keeping it interesting this year. Martin Boozer completed his 24-hour layover early in the race. Lance Mackey and Sonny Lindner appear to be embracing the opposite strategy, making their way down the trail to the Iditarod checkpoint, which is also the official halfway marker in the race. But many of the veteran mushers decided to stick to a plan they know, resting in the popular 24-hour layover village of Takotna. Emily Schwing is at the checkpoint and has this report.
Snow fell on Martin Boozer's team as he cruised into Takotna and dropped his snow hook. He only planned to stay long enough to drop two dogs and snack the remaining 14.
Leave a couple of dogs here.
As the four-time champion switched dogs around, he chatted and sang to them.
Oh, he's getting trouble. Trouble will find me. There we go, huh, Kitten? Now it's your turn to lead.
But he wasn't in the mood to talk to anyone else.
Let me do my work. This is not probably not the best time to chat.
He sped off 8 minutes after arriving.
Hi.
12-time finisher Allie Zirkel says she usually stops in Takotna.
So, Takotna's pretty lush for the mushers as well as the dogs. It's exactly, in my view, like a 300-mile race into it.
The Iditarod is in its 41st year, but only in the last 15 or so has it become standard practice to claim 24 hours rest at the 300-mile mark.
So you can get a pretty good view of what your team looks like as far as, you know, 300 miles, and then assess your situation.
Martin Boozer's strategy is one many mushers used to execute, albeit with a whole lot more rest. 27 teams were snuggled under blankets and bedded down in straw as Boozer sped through the race's eighth checkpoint. Over the last 2 days, all those teams have been traveling relatively close together.
Oh, I love it. Another within 24 hours of leaving here, it won't be like that anymore.
John Baker holds the race record. This is his 17th Iditarod.
I have a team that's doing just fine right now, so I choose to let them try and do what they think they need to do, because I know what I'm doing can work, so I'll stick with what I know works.
There are mushers like Martin Boozer who sped through Takotna to find rest elsewhere. Jason Mackey plans to bed his team down in Iditarod. Lance Mackey says his plan is to head all the way into Anvik. Jake Berkowitz is currently in Ophir, resting his team until early Thursday morning. John Baker says he appreciates all the strategies mushers have for resting on the trail.
It's so neat to see, first of all, Martin competing and trying something different and making things happen. I absolutely love that. He's probably the most experienced musher in the field, so anything that he does is going to demand a lot of respect, which it should.
16-time finisher Paul Gebhardt says even though mushers are only a third of the way into the race, there is some method to the seeming madness in Takotna.
The first 300 miles is probably the toughest 300 miles as far as conditions go, physical conditions for the dogs. And when you leave here, you're going uphill, so your dog team doesn't just take off and start loping or something stupid. You know, they can't go that fast going uphill, so it kind of lets them have time to work out all the lactic acid and stuff in their body.
Gebhardt also sees the next run to Ophir as a sort of insurance policy. If one of his dogs has a problem, it's not so bad to carry it for the next 20 miles. Once teams leave Ophir, they have another 80 miles before they hit the Iditarod checkpoint. On the Iditarod Trail in Takotna, I'm Emily Schwing.
A small airplane servicing the Iditarod Trail sled dog race flipped while taking off, but both people on board walked away unharmed. Alaska State Troopers say the Iditarod Air Force plane was piloted by 57-year-old Diana Morinay of Chugiak, a community on the north side of Anchorage. Troopers from Aniak late yesterday afternoon spotted an overturned Cessna 185 at the town site of Iditarod. The former mining town is a race checkpoint 280 miles northwest of Anchorage. Troopers say the plane had dropped off supplies and, when taking off again, lost altitude, struck the Iditarod River, and flipped, Troopers say the plane was seriously damaged. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, passionate testimony in favor of keeping the White Mountain Recreation Area pristine.
It's a beautiful place. It's an amazing place. And there's so many people making their livings up there, off the recreation.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast is open for business with courses in accounting, information systems, and public administration. Degree programs and courses available online. Learn more at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by University of Alaska Southeast.
Delegates in Thailand are scheduled to decide tomorrow whether to increase protections for polar bears under an international treaty that regulates trade of endangered species. The United States is proposing to upgrade the polar bear listing to the highest level of protections under the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, or CITES. If it passes, it will ban international commercial trade of polar bear fur and other parts. Bruce Woods is a spokesman for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Alaska.
Trade in polar bears is still relatively high, and trades in the skins has actually increased in recent years. And we believe that the current level of trade could have a detrimental impact on the status of the species, because trade, in particular commercial trade, compounds the threat to the species that's posed by habitat loss.
But the world's leading group of polar bear experts is recommending against increased protections for the bears under the CITES treaty. The Polar Bear Specialist Group of the International Union for the Conservation of Nature says the listing, called Appendix 1, isn't likely to help conserve polar bears. Ian Sterling is an adjunct professor from the University of Alberta and a member of the Polar Bear Specialist Group. He doesn't think the listing will do much to curb illegal hunting of polar bears, which is mostly happening in Russia.
If you look at what's happening with African elephant ivory, it's had a ban on it for some time, and there was an article in the paper this morning here in Edmonton on the extensive illegal sale of African ivory all over the place on from various internet sites. So it seems to me that if there's money to be made on it, that that whoever's doing it illegally in Russia is probably going to find outlets. So it seems to me that a ban would not really make it difficult for people who are already operating fairly well-organized fashion illegally.
We've already sort of answered this question, certainly, but it just seems kind of counterintuitive at first glance, I think, to people. Why did the Polar Bear Specialist Group recommend not uplisting the polar bear under CITES?
Because we didn't think that the uplisting or that international trade, we didn't feel was the most significant thing affecting the long-term survival of polar bears. The big issue, the elephant in the room, so to speak, is climate warming. And that's the thing we really need to address in terms of the bears. And that short-term fix for 2 or 3 or 5 years or whatever relative to international trade would probably do more harm than good in overall, or maybe not in Russia, but in a lot of other countries where there is important cultural and economic benefit to local people, to indigenous people in Alaska, Canada, and Greenland. You would make that more difficult and essentially be maybe tarring them with suggesting that they're really not doing things in a reasonable fashion, which basically they are. It's not really based on science. It's based far more on an anti-hunting emotion, just generally, I think.
So you're suggesting that an Appendix 1 listing could actually have a negative impact on polar bears?
In some countries, that's possible. We don't know for sure, but for example, in Canada and in Greenland, I'm not sure exactly what the situation in Alaska is, but it's probably similar. The number of problem bears coming into settlements, certainly in Canada, has greatly increased. Some of that is as a consequence of climate warming. But right at the moment, because bears have some value and are traded both nationally and internationally and have a value locally, It means that, people spend a great deal of effort trying to chase problem bears out of town and help them survive so that ostensibly down the road they're helping to maintain the population so they can have a sustainable harvest. I think there will be a backlash and a lot of anger from native people in some of these countries to CITES I listing that removes some options from them. Will create a situation where polar bears are viewed as less, quotation marks, valuable for themselves, although the internal and subsistence and traditional use will continue. And it's quite likely that that people may just be angry, and any bear that shows up in town is thought to be threatening is simply going to be killed outright. And that has the potential of in fact, ending up killing more bears than are being killed under a quota-driven system.
Ian Sterling is a member of the Polar Bear Specialist Group under the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. More than 60 people showed up for a second public hearing in Fairbanks last night on a proposal that could permit mining in the White Mountain National Recreation Area. And like last month's meeting, most strongly encouraged the Bureau of Land Management to maintain a current ban on mining. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
You couldn't help but notice the passion in the voices of the three dozen people who got up to speak at the hearing held at the Morris Thompson Cultural and Visitors Center. One after another shared personal stories of their deep connection to the White Mountains National Recreation Area, developed over decades of hiking, skiing, hunting, fishing, and camping there with family and friends. Like Jenna Hertz, who talked about last month's ski trip.
It's really amazing that we have this place that's in our backyard, really close and really inexpensive and really rich, and that we can share it with so many people. It's really a gift, and it's something that I love about living here.
Craig Smith urged the Federal Bureau of Land Management officials to maintain the agency's existing policy that bans mining in the White Mountains to protect the sustainable outdoor recreation economy that thrives here because of the nearby attraction.
It's a beautiful place. It's an amazing place. And there's so many people making their livings up there, off the recreation.
All but three of the speakers urged the BLM to reject the proposed provision for hard rock mineral leasing in about 16% of the million-acre White Mountains National Recreation Area. The BLM doesn't favor mining in the recreation area, but the agency included the provision during a routine revision of the document that spells out the management plan for BLM lands in the eastern interior that include the recreation area. Rourke Williams says BLM should adopt the mining provision because it would allow for further exploration in the recreation area for rare earth elements, which are essential for manufacturing materials used in optics and high-tech devices.
I don't want to see a big mine up there. I really don't. But I think we should find out what we've got before the discussion of closing those areas off permanently, because we all use these rare earth minerals in our everyday life.
But John Schauer says even exploring for rare earths would seriously impact the recreation area.
And when we talk about rare earth minerals, those are low concentration deposits, hard rock mine, and just the exploration, they're talking about some big impacts, not just helicopters, but pushing a road into the White Mountains rec area that doesn't exist today.
BLM officials say a final decision on the Area Resource Management Plan will be issued next year. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
A new service allows Fairbanks North Star Borough residents to share information that emergency responders can access. Fairbanks is the first community in Alaska to subscribe to Smart 911, a national service that enables dispatchers to access caller-submitted profiles. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Participation in Smart 911 is totally voluntary. That's something Fairbanks Dispatch Center Manager Stephanie Johnson makes very clear, recognizing the Big Brother phobia. Johnson says if you opt in, you also choose what to provide in your profile.
They can associate multiple telephone numbers with that Smart 911 profile. They can associate the people living in a residence, pictures of your household, pets. They can share any information that emergency responders would need to know. My driveway's a mile and a half long, and you got to walk the last three quarters of a mile in, you know, whatever kind of information that's pertinent to a responder. And this will allow the dispatchers to provide that to our first responders, whether it's law enforcement, fire, or medical.
Johnson says profiles are strictly protected by Smart 911, a Massachusetts-based company, and they only become temporarily viewable by a local dispatcher when you call for help. With an increasing amount of 911 calls coming from cell phones, Johnson says profiles can help determine the location of a caller, as well as provide health information that can aid in serving a person in distress.
So if you have a history of asthma and you call and you're not able to speak in full sentences, they're going to be able to see your 911 profile that you have asthma, if that's what you chose to share.
Dispatch centers and other communities that subscribe to Smart 911 are also able to access your profile if you call for help while outside Fairbanks. Borough Emergency Operations Director David Gibbs says Fairbanks is the only community in Alaska currently subscribed, but the service is also available in areas of the lower 48.
It's becoming more and more common. I mean, there have been large-scale deployments of Smart 911 in certain states and local governments, particularly around the Illinois, Chicago, Greater Chicago area, and then down in the southeast.
The Smart 911 subscription costs the borough $19,000 a year. Gibbs says there's no associated cost savings, and it's intended solely to provide better emergency response.
We could make the argument if you save one life, it's paid for itself.
Gibbs says the borough is reaching out to local groups and agencies that serve people with disabilities and special needs to encourage their clients to participate. Anyone who lives in the North Star borough can create a Smart 911 profile online. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
As the state of Alaska has grown, the capital city of Juneau has adapted and grown along with it. Two former legislators yesterday discussed those changes and the challenges Juneau has faced over the years. The talk was part of the Alaska Legislature's Centennial Commission program, which took place in the capital city this week to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the Alaska Legislature. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
Mike Miller served Juneau in the State House of Representatives from 1971 to 1986. When he was sworn in as a freshman, the state office building was just 6 years old. Many state employees still worked out of the Capitol building because of a lack of office space in Juneau. So Miller says the only lawmakers to get their own offices were committee chairs.
All the members that didn't have an office, their office was their chair in the chambers. Yeah, and there was a custom that was developed that as you went to your own chair, your own office in the chambers, you never looked down at somebody else's desk because that would be like intruding on their office.
Clark Greening grew up in Juneau and later served downtown Anchorage for two terms in the State House. Today, almost every legislator has a staff of at least two employees. Greening says in his day, they were lucky to have secretaries.
My first session in 1975, Steve Cooper was also on the Finance Committee, and we shared an office and one staff person.
Eventually, the state began leasing more offices in Juneau, allowing every lawmaker to have their own room in the Capitol. Over the years, the city and borough of Juneau has also donated facilities to the state Capitol complex, including the old Juneau High School, now the Terry Miller Building, and more recently, the Scottish Rite Temple, now the Tom Stewart Building. Greening says Juneau residents realize the importance of promoting the city as Alaska's capital.
Juneau took a very proactive stance to promote and support local funding for capital city improvements.
In 1974, Alaska voters passed an initiative to move the capital to the road system. A measure to fund the move failed, as did four other capital move votes in 1960, 1962, 1994, and 2002. Those in favor of moving the capital say it's too far from the state's big population centers. But Miller says transportation to and from Juneau has improved immensely.
We've got a system that I'm so proud of, the ferry system. I well remember when the first large ship, the Malaspina, came in. You know, if you'd been a burglar, you could have rifled every house in Juneau because everybody was on the dock.
Back in the 70s, there was no limit on how long a legislative session could last. Greening says lawmakers in the still young state would spend close to half a year in Juneau working on issues like the permanent fund and oil taxes. The 120-day session was established in the state constitution in 1984. Then in 2006, voters narrowly approved a 90-day session in statute. Well, he wouldn't go back to the days of unlimited sessions. Greening thinks 90 days is too short.
The unlimited session was not good because people couldn't afford to stay there, had jobs to get back to. And most, I do think, overall, it was a good balance at 120.
Miller says the biggest change over the years is electronic access to the state capitol.
Instead of just having an occasional telephone call with somebody in Igigik or in Barrow or out the chain, you can attend a meeting and just almost feel that you're there.
As for the future, Miller says another state office complex should be built in Juneau.
My hope is that someday we won't be leasing, we'll be building and owning.
Such a facility was in the works as recently as 2 years ago before the Parnell administration redirected funds for planning and design into remodeling the Department of Fish and Game building in Douglas. The Alaska Legislature Centennial Commission program took place in Juneau this week at the old Elks Lodge, the original meeting place of the territorial legislature. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
And finally tonight, a correction. A story that aired last night about the territorial legislature centennial misidentified a member of the cast in the reenactment. Odin Brody played the role of Charles Ingersoll. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing in Takotna, Tim Ellis and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Casey Kelly in Juneau. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
And by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. You have the power to help others when you file online for your PFD. It's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give. You can make a real difference and support causes that matter most to you, from feeding the hungry, supporting youth in education, or sustaining the arts. Learn more at pickclickgive.org. This message sponsored by ExxonMobil, North Rim Bank, and Doyon Limited.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.